Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to WriteStream Tuesday. This is your host, Daria Ann, the founder of the WriteStream Radio Network here on Blog Talk Radio, and I want to thank you for joining me today. Before we get started on today's special program, which for the first time on WriteStream, today we're going to actually have a panel with some very successful authors, both traditionally published and independently published, and we're going to be talking about a variety of things. With the overall theme of offering advice about how to succeed as an author in the marketplace, whether you go the traditional route or whether you decide to independently publish. And along the way, we're also going to be talking about things like conservative fiction and conservative feminism. So I'm really looking forward to today's panel, and I invite you to call in at 347-945-7246 if you have any questions or comments. And, of course, I've got the chat room open here, so if you'd like to post a question or a comment in the chat room, I'll be happy to address it with the panel. Sometimes I know people are shy about calling in, so they like to do that. Just a really quick programming note, though, before we get started, because I see that I have all of my authors of today's panel on the line. I'm so excited. Let me just remind everyone about the WriteStream Radio Network. We have three programs currently broadcasting on this network on Blog Talk Radio. Sundays, we have Just Believe with Lisa Tarvez. Lisa is a certified holistic health practitioner and an intuitive. And every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern, she has on some fascinating guests in the realm of paranormal, spirituality, self-help, health and wellness, just a variety of uplifting topics that she covers every week. So be sure to check her out every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. And on Mondays, we have Military Monday with John D. Gresham. And John is a military historian, journalist, and author who covers all aspects of the United States military and all things having to do with national defense, terrorism, war, history. It's just a fascinating show. He's another excellent host. So I hope that you will take the time to check out Military Monday with John D. Gresham every Monday here on the WriteStream Radio Network at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And the great thing about Blog Talk Radio is that everything is archived. So if you want to check out programs that have already aired, just go to blogtalkradio.com/ WriteStream. And you can follow us on Twitter using hashtag WriteStream as well. All right, everyone. Well, without further ado, I want to go ahead and start bringing on the panel here for today. We have Jamie K. Wilson, who is a returning guest on the show. Jamie is the senior editor of Liberty Island Media and also the founder of Conservative Fiction and Conservative Feminism. And I know there are probably many more things that Jamie does that I've neglected to mention, but I'm going to give each of our panel an opportunity to talk about their careers and what they do before we get started today. I also have author Michelle Buckman and author Griff Griffith on today. So without further ado, let me bring on today's panel. Let me make their mics go live here. And okay, hold on. Hopefully everyone's on the line. Welcome, everyone. Do I have Jamie?
You do.
Hey, Jamie, how are you?
Oh, I'm great. How are you?
Great. Well, thanks for coming back. I'm really looking forward to today's show.
I am too. I think this will be fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Excuse me. I don't know why my throat is so scratchy all of a sudden. I know I also have Michelle Buckman on the line, who is a traditionally published author. Hey, Michelle.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Great. And last but definitely not least, we have Griff Griffith. Griff, are you there?
Yes, ma'am. Can you hear me?
Yes. I can hear you really well. Well, panel, I want to thank you for being here. And what I wanted to start off with is by giving you each of you an opportunity to kind of introduce yourselves, tell us about your background, and then we'll get into some of these topics as the show progresses. So, Jamie, why don't I start with you, and then Michelle will go to you, and then Griff.
Okay. Most of what I do right now is run conservativefiction.com, and everything that's attached to it right now, we've got an email list, which everybody's very active on. We have the Conservative Fiction Forum, which I'm trying to get more active because that's a lot more public. And we're getting ready to do a lovely retreat up in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. That will be, the 23rd through the 27th, I believe. And we're just, you know, anybody who's interested in that can contact me. It's free. We're just coming together. We're talking about conservative fiction and what it really means and the things that we can do to promote conservative fiction, either our own stuff or other people's stuff. And it's kind of a formative thing. I'm also getting ready to open up a writing workshop out on the forum, which is another big reason I'm trying to get that moving. And we're going to try to grow some writers.
Fantastic.
Other than that, I'm sorry?
No, fantastic, Jamie. But can you what month is the retreat? I know you said the 23rd, but what was
July.
July.
I haven't had enough sleep for 2 weeks now, so it's catching up with me. Yeah, July the 23rd through 27th, I believe.
Excellent. Yeah, Jamie, you were also the mother of 5 children, which I neglected to mention in my intro. So you're entitled to be sleep deprived.
Yeah, and a husband who's getting ready to deploy, so none of those help.
Okay. Michelle, let's go to you and just introduce yourself and tell us about your books and your career.
Hello. I'm the mother of 5 kids, too, so I get to be a little bit brainy, too.
Busy lady.
I started out as a freelance writer and a newspaper columnist, and now I am the editor of a Charlotte magazine, the author of 6 novels, and I teach workshops at various writing retreats and conferences, including Jamie's upcoming retreat.
Fabulous, and we're definitely going to talk about that today. And Griff, last but not least, are you there?
There we go.
There we go.
That sound better?
All right. Yeah, there he is.
All right. It's great to be here. Am I too loud?
No, this is perfect.
Terrific. Well, it's thanks for the opportunity because I have corresponded extensively with Jamie, and Michelle's been very generous with her time as well. But it's the first time I've actually had a chance to speak to them, so that's terrific. let's see. My writing career is mostly alleged. I've been writing since I was 10. I was a member of the Writers Guild. I was hired to write a teleplay for Fox TV, actually, and it was based on a terrible novel by Frank Herbert. And in a really typical Hollywood experience, I wrote the screenplay, I was paid, and then they fired the vice president of the network and threw out all his projects, which included mine.
Oh.
Yeah. But it was actually it was okay because my son was about 2 years old at the time, and I really needed to be a dad then. I think I know myself well enough to know if I'd had any success in Hollywood, I would have been a real jerk. You know, I would have spent my time having starlets rub coconut oil on me and not been a dad. And it was probably a lot more important than as a father. And I continue to write. I've always written. And wrote a couple of novels, and that was actually how I made Jamie's acquaintance through Liberty Island.
And excellent.
That's where I'm at.
Well, you know, one thing I just noticed right off the bat is it's just phenomenal, and we're going to talk about this today, how social media and new technology has brought people together. Because, you know, I heard you just say that this is the first time you're talking, you know, to each other. Griff, is that correct? And so it's kind of exciting to see this, to see how, you know, proof of how technology has really kind of made the world a lot smaller.
Yes, ma'am.
I'd like to comment on that.
Sure.
When I first started writing, the internet didn't exist. That tells you how old I am. And I lived in a town where there was absolutely no writers. It was a little tiny country town. And I had no support group, no writers groups or anything. And when we finally moved to a bigger area, I joined a traditional writing group, which helped a lot. And then eventually an internet group when the internet came to be, which was just, it was so fascinating to be able to talk to writers all over the world. And actually, my second book is co-authored with a writer in Canada. We didn't even meet until 3 years ago. We finally met. We wrote the whole thing through email and chatting online. So that was great fun, and it's just amazing the things that you can do online now. It's fantastic.
Wow, that is incredible. You know what, and Michelle, since I want to ask you, since you are our traditionally published author, first, like, tell us a little bit about what that experience was like for you as you were starting out your career and the whole process of getting a traditional publisher. And then I'm going to ask you and everyone else on the panel for their thoughts on new technology and has it been a net positive for the publishing and writing industry in general, and what are some of the pitfalls. But tell us about just kind of how you were able to get a publisher, you know, in the, back in the beginning there before the internet and all this good stuff came along.
Ooh, it was really depressing, really, because you're struggling, especially when there wasn't this internet connection and you're kind of just working in the dark. I think I bought every single book that Writer's Digest magazine had in, you know, its little flyer that it puts in the back. I bought everything and read everything, and was basically self-taught on the process because I had no one mentoring me to help me out. And that really helped a lot, is to really just research. And I studied other people's novels. Like, every novel I have has lines in it of what's good, what's bad, what works. And I would just study them cover to cover and keep myself surrounded with them when I was writing. And then it was just a matter of, it's really perseverance. Even if with the online stuff you have now, it's perseverance. It's really just battling it out and sticking with it and keep improving yourself and finding ways to break through. And in the end, I finally started going to conferences, which is another thing I highly recommend, because networking, whether you're doing it online or in person, when you meet someone in person at a conference that will mentor you or is an agent or editor and you talk to them personally about your book, your chances of being published go up 100% because they know you. They put a face to a manuscript, and then you actually do get some attention. My first agent was because we were both late getting into a luncheon at a conference, and so we sat together, and by the end of lunch, she was like, I want to read your manuscript, and a couple of weeks later, I had an agent. So, and everything has been like that. Every time, it's been the ones that I have actually met in person. So I highly recommend that.
Wow. Yeah, so, you know, technology can take us to a point, but I think there's nothing that takes the place of that face-to-face interaction. And my gosh, your story is proof of that. Jamie, tell us a little bit about, though, let me go back to something you said in the beginning. Tell us a little bit about conservative fiction and how that came about.
It came about because I got mad because I was throwing too many books against the wall due to liberal content and Sarah Palin bashing and stuff like that. But I went out and bought the domain name because I was shocked nobody had bought that domain name. And about a year later, Kia Heavy contacted me and said, "Are you going to do anything with this?" I was like, "Well, I was going to, but maybe I should go ahead and start." And I started blogging a little bit about it, and I made contact with a bunch of people that Kia knew, and then I started finding conservative writers, and it snowballed from there. I got the idea to put together an email list just so I could bring together what I call drops of water, you know, people who are all by themselves. They've been pretty much ostracized by the liberal writing community, and so they're kind of by themselves. They don't really have contact with other writers. They aren't able to get any good feedback because what they're writing turns off the people who are reading it. And so I'm trying to bring together those drops of water into the email list and into the forum so that those people can then learn from each other and build on each other's contacts, and we can really, really grow a network. That's what the whole thing's about. But it all came about because Kia Heavy contacted me one day and said, "Hey, you ever going to do anything with this?"
That's amazing.
And it was great.
Did she send you an email, Jamie, or did she call you?
It was an email.
Of course, yeah.
Almost everything I've done has been online.
Right.
Partly
That's
because
amazing.
I'm, you know, kind of a shy person in a lot of ways. Not shy, I'm an introvert. And I'm not really a phone person, but I'm learning.
And you're doing great.
And,
you know, and Kia, I should mention, well, actually, Jamie, I need to thank you because I've been able to book so many guests on WriteStream thanks to your efforts and connecting
They're wonderful people. It's a wonderful group.
It's great. And, you know what, let me give a shout-out to Robert Bertrand because we gave him a shout-out last week when I interviewed Kia, but he definitely deserves it again because he actually introduced us, I believe, on Twitter. So,
yeah. Yes, he did.
So now, for anyone listening, though, let's just define conservative fiction. So I'll go ahead and give you – what is conservative fiction exactly, Jamie, when you say that?
Well, see, we're all arguing about that. We're trying to define it. To me, it's fiction that adheres to not politically conservative stuff, but the conservative ideals, you know, a strong family, strong heroes, especially strong heroes, positive values. We don't like anti-heroes. We like people who, you know, you can look up to. You can say, "Oh my gosh, I want to be like that guy." You know, people that you can really empathize with because they're great people. It's a rejection of a lot of the stuff that's going on right now in contemporary fiction, where you've got these nasty anti-heroes. You've got Dexter out there who's, he does good, I guess, but he's kind of a nasty person. You've got characters like House, who is also a fascinating character, but a nasty person. You know, they like these complex characters. I think we all agree that we can create complex characters that aren't just absolute turnoffs as people, that you can look at and say, you know, I would like to be that guy's friend. I think that's what we're trying to get.
Yeah. Griff, you want to weigh in on that?
Actually, sorry. I'd rather hear what Michelle has to say. I'm still sort of formulating my thoughts. Punt.
Well, my feeling is, they don't have to start out being good characters. Because if you read Rachel's Contrition, Rachel is really a mixed up, I could use stronger words of how bad a person she is. It's that the main character needs to change. When they become a hero, it needs to cultivate something new in them. And because of that, they become a new person. Because that is what we see as the outcome of life, is that your goal is to somehow better yourself and better the world at the same time. The difference between, to me, a hero and an anti-hero would be, or the antagonist, is that the hero is willing to lay down their life for someone else. that's the realization they have. They put someone else before themselves, or even the whole world before themselves, whereas the antagonist does not do that. And when you have a so-called hero that's a horrible person, even if they do something good, that doesn't mean that they've found that change within themselves that makes them a virtuous person. And virtue is what we should be honoring, not just because they did one nice thing.
That's right, I agree with that.
I love that. Okay. That's wonderful.
Griff, have you formulated your thoughts on this?
Well, gosh, my response is probably a little more personal. I would venture to say these ladies have been thinking about this longer than I have. I know just for myself, my writing was sort of I think touching somewhat on what Michelle said, but at a certain point, I got tired of reading the stuff. Life is worthless and people are terrible, and I don't think conservative fiction would agree with that. I believe conservative fiction sees that people are not simply victims, that we in fact have choice, control, and agency, and dare I say it, responsibility for a lot of how our lives turn out. And that, to me, is different than a lot of modern fiction. I mean, you know, a lot of it may have been a reaction to World War II, and oh my God, it was horrible, and it was. There's no question. But I think I personally have grown tired of reading works by people who haven't done anything in their life and who talk about oh my gosh, the Western society is so heartless and there's no beauty, and these are people who've lived pampered lives, and
yep,
all they're doing is complaining. I would suggest, yeah, so conservative fiction is about the fact we have choice, responsibility, potential, and it's not as much about complaining as it is about changing.
And I agree with that statement as well, and I think what I would add to that is that we would like the fiction to show consequences for actions,
mm-hmm.
that when people do things that are immoral or just plain wrong, that you see a consequence to that and not la-di-da. My children turned on a movie the other night, and I don't even know what the name of it was, about this guy that liked to kill people. And I made them turn it off because it was just so disgusting. And I said, just tell me how it ends. And they said, oh, he ends up killing this other person so that nobody finds out, and blah, blah. And I'm like, he doesn't get in trouble for this. He never gets caught. And they're like, no. And I'm like, why would you watch that movie? Why would you watch something that is glorifying someone who likes to kill people? Yep. I don't understand that. And that's what's wrong with what's coming out today. There has to be consequences.
Oh, I agree, Michelle. Go ahead, Jamie.
They've gotten good and bad and positive and negative all mixed up. You hear so many kids these days who admire the villains in movies. Darth Vader was this huge kind of hero to everybody when the real Star Wars movies came out, you know, the first three, because Darth Vader was the motivator through the whole thing. Everything centered around him, and that's why when Lucas went and did the prequels, they were all centered around who Darth Vader was, because that was the character that captivated everyone. We don't want that. That's bad. You want people to be captivated by the positive characters, by the Captain Americas out there, you know?
Yeah.
By the Avengers,
yeah.
Not by the Lokis. So that's part of what we're about, too. Speaking of active heroes, I'm going to plug Griff, because Griff is going to be on television on Thursday night on Race to the Scene, which is a very interesting sort of game show reality TV thing on, what station is that?
It's on the Reels cable channel.
Yeah, Reels Network, right.
Yeah, we got to hang out with Dolph Lundgren, who's you know, he's the real thing. This is guy, you know, he's done movies and made a living doing it, but he's actually got a black belt in karate, and he's got a chemistry degree, master's from MIT. So this is a guy he's actually done something. Nice fellow. And Jamie informs me, and so does my wife, that he's also a conservative on the down low.
Yeah.
Again,
I've
accomplishment.
Heard that,
yeah. You know, he's a guy who's done stuff instead of talked about stuff. But that's just my personal opinion.
Yeah, and I think, guys, I just want to make one comment on what you had, what we were talking about before, just quickly, and I want you to weigh in on it. But I just call it, I look at it as the Jerry Springerization of our culture, where, you know, we're talking about these anti-heroes being celebrated in fiction, but they're celebrated in real life, just like you were saying, Griff, about, I picture, like, people in Hollywood at these award shows patting themselves on the back for how brave they are, and I'm thinking, really? Like, hello, what did you really do? You're marginally talented, you're making all kinds of money, and you're trashing the country. So what's so great about that? But it seems like in our culture, on television, in the movies, like you said, Michelle, we're celebrating the basis of human behavior. It's disgusting.
Yeah, well, I was going to add on. So this segues nicely. You're asking, you know, what is conservative fiction? Well, we sort of talk about what we think it is, but I think, at least in my mind, one of the things I want to achieve is I want to change the mental map that a lot of people in America, through the culture, have gotten. I think that's one of the real problems. You know, the mental map is, and the ladies, please jump in on this, but the mental map is, yeah, the anti-heroes, you know, they're the true, honest people who speak truth to power. The mental map is that the liberals are the nice people. They're the compassionate people. And,
right.
You know, when that,
and
that...
We saw that played out. We saw that played out, didn't we, when we had Occupy Wall Street?
Oh, my word, yes.
yes.
You know, and so I think that that's a important part of what conservative fiction, at least what I'm trying to do, is to change the mental map to say, okay, here's the story. Here's the story you've been told. A lot of modern media, to me, is about the moral. So they'll slant their news coverage of, say, shootings. You know, you always get the stories of horrible shootings, unarmed people gunned down by guy with rifle. They never emphasize, typically, it's a mentally ill individual with a weapon. But so few times will you get the story of the shootings that were stopped by someone carrying a legal weapon who drew down on the idiot, who had enough survival instinct to go, wow, there's somebody shooting back, I'd better stop. The reason we don't hear those stories is it doesn't have the neat moral of, and guns, little children, are bad.
Yeah, it doesn't fit the narrative at all, the leftist narrative.
Right. And I just think of it as a moral because they keep telling us these fairy tales. And in conservative fiction, I think we need to, again, put out a new mental map we can tell people. Because when I was small, I wasn't wanted to be a liberal, you know, as a young kid, because you see it in all the movies. You see To Kill a Mockingbird, right? Atticus Finch, obviously liberal, standing up. He's a good guy. Well, who doesn't want to be that guy, you know? Well, at least when I was 10. But that's the pervasive story that's pushed constantly, is that the liberals are the nice, the good people. And then I married a liberal, and got to experience that close up. Which, that's another story, though.
that's not your current wife, right?
No. And thank God. And I hope no bitterness leaked out in my voice while I was telling that story.
Yeah. Griff, let me just say I can relate, because I never married a liberal, but many, many years ago I dated one. And let me tell you, I said never again after that experience. So.
Yeah, that was the collision of reality with the fairy tale.
Yeah. Michelle, you want to weigh in on that? On not on marriage, being married to a liberal necessarily, but what Griff.
Yeah, I'm not married to a liberal. I think that that would end very badly if it was.
And it did. It certainly did.
Yeah, I'm way too conservative, and my husband just listens and nods.
Michelle, I did want to ask you real quick, and I'm sorry, I'm like jumping all over here, but because you are in the traditionally, you know, you're in the traditionally published world. Did you experience or did you notice any other authors or potential authors experience any kind of bias from traditional publishers because maybe the themes of their book were too pro-American or pro-traditional values or whatever the case might be with conservatism?
Well, I'm actually not just a conservative writer, and I'm not just a Christian writer. I'm a Catholic writer. So my journey went from a New York agent loving my work to trying to sell it all over New York and being told my work was too Christian. And then Christian has a saying it was too Catholic. So I had to write it. I had to take the Catholicism out to get my first book published and wrote everything non-denominational for several books until I finally found a Catholic publisher that was willing to try some fiction, and then I actually got to make my characters Catholic. So as far as being just conservative, that hasn't come into play, but the faith issue has. So we'll see. This, my next book is not not really Catholic except in the decisions, the conservative decisions that they make. So we'll see what happens with this manuscript.
Excellent. And where, you know, I should give you an opportunity to play. Now, where can people find your books, Michelle, since we're on that topic? Give you a chance to plug your work.
Easily on Amazon. They're all on Amazon. The first one is out of print, but, and the second one was co-authored. But I have Maggie Come Lately and My Beautiful Disaster, which are teen novels. And then Death Panels, which is
Maggie Come Lately won awards.
Rachel's Contrition, yes, that won the Catholic Arts and Letters Award, and Maggie Come Lately was a finalist for the Christie Award.
Right.
Cool.
Congratulations.
Yeah, she is really that good, guys.
Well, thank you.
And Michelle, what is your website? I put a link in the chat room, but just for anyone listening, what's your website address?
It's michellebuckman.com, M-I-C-H-E-L-L-E. BUCKMAN.com, not to be confused with Michelle Bachman. We got each other's web hits for a while, but I think people will finally figure it out. But it's good that we share the same politics, so that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just going to say, not such a bad thing.
Right.
So, you know, just getting back to the culture, so, you know, it does. I think, and Jamie, you and I talked about this the last time you were on WriteStream, you know, just about how, and I'm so, like, I love what you're doing, and that's why I'm so happy to do whatever I can do to help promote it, because we don't have the big money donors on our side. I mean, we were talking, the topic of the 2012 election came up last time you were on, and I think I made the comment, like, if only some of these big GOP donors would really put their money behind culture warriors and what we're doing, because it's really all about the message. It's not about the party. And this speaks to Griff and Michelle, what you all were saying earlier, too, about how, you know, the perception is that liberals are good people, and if you're a conservative, you're evil. Well, Arthur C. Brooks kind of shattered that myth with his book, Who Really Cares? When he did his research, he's a professor, I believe, at Syracuse University, and his research proved, and the guy was a liberal, I think, at the time, and he said, you know, I really didn't want my research to prove this, but I discovered that conservatives outgive liberals 2-1, because the basic difference there is that conservatives believe it's up to the individual to give, whereas the left and liberals are all about statism, and, you know, they just want the government to give away your money for whatever their purposes are and call that a good thing. But Jamie, you know, we were talking about that, and I just it frustrates me that that we all know that, but it frustrates me that people with deep pockets haven't caught on to this. And I just wanted to get each of you to kind of weigh in on that.
I think that's getting ready to change. You heard what happened with Rick Santorum the other day, right? He took a position as the CEO of a Christian filmmaking company. And Rick Santorum, boy, he's got some access to deep pockets. So that's going to change right there. Also, I'm finding organizations like the Liberty 21 Institute, which I don't know a lot about them right now. I've just started talking to a couple of people there. But they have got all kinds of things going on And they state as one of their main goals, building a conservative cultural infrastructure. Let me just read this to you really quickly. Popular culture is a key driver of the attitudes and mores of the American people, but conservative works of art and pop culture are not often welcomed by the gatekeepers who convey prestige on such works. Liberty 21 is working to build an infrastructure that will support right-minded artists through reviews, grants, awards, and other means of cultural approbation. So you are not the only person that thinks that. I am not the only person that thinks that. We've got some fairly important people who are starting to think that, too.
That's fantastic.
This is something that's going to happen. And we just happen to be one of the cogs that's kind of coalesced and is getting involved in it. So I'm seeing things like this pop up everywhere, and it's amazing.
That's fantastic. Griff, you want to weigh in?
Yeah.
There is the evil Koch brothers. We always hope they'll do something. I live in California, so it's pretty amusing to watch people having aneurysms over the thought that they might buy the LA Times. For them, it's like us thinking the Saudis were buying the Vatican or something. That's just sort of idle amusement. But there are some things starting to happen. For instance, my publisher is Liberty Island. They are hoping to be, I get the sense, they're dealing in submissions in every genre of popular fiction, but I almost get a feel they're going for a conservative Atlantic, if you will, because they're hoping to really address a lot of these, and they're one of the first ones I'd heard of, and that's how I made Jamie's acquaintance, to my everlasting delight. It is out there, and I think it's probably that we're getting very close to that moment in time where you have a solution that's saturated, and it just needs that last crystal of sugar added, and then all of a sudden things are going to start precipitating. I believe there is a great hunger out there, because half of Americans who voted for Romney, and it probably wasn't because they were all Mormon. I think people are anxious and they're tired of being told they're stupid, they're mean, they're racist, they're unkind.
And that half of Americans read stories too. They consume entertainment, and they're not being entertained right now. They're actually being pretty pissed about that.
Right, exactly.
Well, Griff, what do you make of the idea? We always hear about how Hollywood is all about money, but yet, they refuse to make movies that actually make money. Like on those rare occasions when a film is made that actually celebrates either Christianity or conservative values or American values, that film usually does really well, but yet they're so few and far between. So, and yet we see all this recycled garbage that they keep putting out there, sequels to things that really shouldn't have a sequel, or remakes. They just keep rehashing the same stuff, and yet when they do make a movie that's pro-traditional values, let's say, it usually succeeds, but yet they refuse to do that. So if they're really all about money, why wouldn't they make more of those kinds of films?
Well, I think there's two things going on. One, the kinds of films you're talking about, like The Passion of the Christ or Fireproof. Fireproof was a great little movie. God love them.
It was.
Those essentially came from outside the system.
Yep.
Mel Gibson had to, he's been a star for a long time, but he had to finance that film himself because nobody would touch it. But I think what happens in Hollywood is that first, any conservatives there have been so beaten down, for the most part, they've been ostracized. There is a blacklist, Roger Simon at PJ Media will be happy to tell you about that. So people keep those parts of themselves quiet, so they aren't necessarily stepping up or rewarded for doing so, and then that leaves the people who are in Hollywood who wouldn't really have a clue about how to make those films, for the most part, because that would mean they would have to change their worldview that maybe there is some value in being pro-America. Maybe America is great. Maybe terrorist bombings are a bad thing. You know, the whole that recent Robert Redford movie, which cost, what, I don't know, $20 million to make, and it's made about $1 million at the box office, about the terrorist bombing, the Bill Ayers clone on the run from the journalist who's going to expose him. But it turns out he did it for good reasons. He was against the Vietnam War, so it was okay to make bombs and kill people. That's their mindset. And for them to make these kinds of conservative movies that would actually appeal to people, they'd have to become somebody else, I think. Or they'd have to have a different experience. And Jamie knows, that's one of the things I sort of touched on in my novel, imagining how some of these people might change their point of view if they had different experiences. But in Hollywood, it's incredibly insular. They talk to the same people. They go to the same clubs. And it's very difficult to get outside of that, to have their experience. And one of the questions I'd love to ask a lot of these people, like Rosie O'Donnell, any of these folks, is how many real conservatives do you know? How many real Christians do you know? Have you actually broken bread with? Have you spent time with? Have you seen close up? You know, we were talking about liberals and their statism, and they just want to take money to run the programs. Well, to me, that's because liberals like to outsource their compassion by reaching into our pockets. And whereas conservatives will actually, they'll give their money over and above the taxes they're already paying, but they'll also give their time and their sweat. Whereas a liberal will just, hey, I voted for Obama, I voted for Jerry Brown, he's going to take care of the little people, and I can feel good about myself. As opposed to, I think conservatives, because we believe it's down to the individual, will more often actually put their own time, sweat, and treasure into the things they think are important.
Yeah. And I think that's because we're taught, I mean, you know, I think most churches, and Michelle, I happen to be Catholic as well, you're taught that, you know, you as the individual, you are supposed to be helping other people. And I believe that was also the attitude, and this is kind of timely given the immigration garbage that's being, you know, foisted upon us by the United States Senate. But I think, you know, one of the big things I believe that characterizes the difference between, like, yesteryear's immigrants and people who come here legally today is that they want that work ethic. They believe in that work ethic. I can speak for my ancestors. They were trying to get away from big government, and it was shameful for anybody to be on welfare for an extended period of time. I mean, because they believed that the shame was that a family member or a neighbor or you know, church congregation didn't help this person get through this temporary setback and help them get back on their feet. I mean, that was the prevailing attitude, and now that's been completely turned around in favor of big government.
Yep.
So another point I wanted to make, you guys, is, I'm sorry, it's like I'm talking all over myself today. But while you were talking, Griffith, I thought of Tim Tebow, and again, this is a cultural thing. You know, why on earth is somebody like Tim Tebow considered quote-unquote controversial, and yet these rappers who make songs about, you know, raping hoes and killing cops, I mean, that's okay. That's somehow okay. Like, they're put on a pedestal. I'm thinking of Jay-Z and people like Beyonce and her little, you know, her little performance at the Super Bowl. That's okay. But Tim Tebow, oh, he's controversial. Why? Because he prays and he lives his faith? I mean, what is the story here?
There's also that football player that's in the news right now who probably murdered somebody. Well, he was controversial before that, but nobody talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
And he is right now in the same position, exactly the same position, on exactly the same team as Tim Tebow.
Yeah.
Jamie, do you want to respond to that? I have a thought, but I want to hear Jamie.
Yeah, I am Jamie, most of the time.
Yeah, but I want to hear your thought about what Ruth just asked, like Daria.
About what exactly?
Why Tim Tebow is considered or treated as controversial and, you know, much more painted and offensive people. Okay.
I don't know why. I guess it's just that's the rhetoric that the media wants out there.
Well, my theory is there's an identified set of enemies.
Dangerous people.
Correct.
People who are dangerous, yes.
Who are bad for the society that the left liberals want to build. And I guess, I think it's important at this point. I don't view liberals as being evil. You know, I'm not a huge conspiracy fan in terms of they want to enslave us all, and although they do want to take away our guns, I'm pretty sure about that. But but I think they are, many are actually doing this with good intentions, in that they think this is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
I think in a lot of ways they're delusional, and I certainly saw that with the liberal wife, you know, that sort of thing. But I think people like Tebow, because he's so proudly a Christian, living his faith, he is one of the, you know, Christianity is one of the identified enemy. That's the oppressor of women and people of color, you know. So therefore, he that's got to be repressed. It's got to be given the black hand. It is verboten. And people like Jay-Z and rappers who talk about killing and raping, well, they're just being, quote, authentic to their culture, which, of course, is just another example of the soft bigotry and reverse racism that you get in liberalism, which is, is the implied, well, we can't really expect them to be any different.
Well, it's part of the white man's burden today to appreciate those cultures, because we haven't appreciated them before.
Oh, it's our penance, which of course is how why I think Barack Obama was elected, because he was a man of no accomplishment and no ability, but the press decided for America's racial sins we needed a black president. Whether the guy had any ability at all didn't matter. What was important was that we atoned for the sins of our past.
Yeah, and Griff, you bring up another interesting point, and Jamie and Michelle, a couple of weeks ago, I interviewed author Balazs Szabo. He wrote a book called Knock in the Night about his experience living behind the Iron Curtain as a kid in Hungary and how he escaped at the age of 13. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he made a very interesting point, and I found, and I want you guys to weigh in on this, I found in my activism that people like him are among the most passionate and the most out there in terms of sounding the alarm, because they've lived through it. They know where this all eventually leads, and it's a nightmare. But Balazs made a great point, and he said, you know, because this topic came up, the topic of slavery and racism, and he said, you know, America is the only country that has bent over backwards to atone for its past sins. He said, you know, every civilization, you know, we're not taught this in school, but every civilization just about has had slaves. I mean, the Romans have had slaves. I happen to be Italian. You know, my heritage happens to be Italian. Should I trace my ancestry back and see if, you know, the Italian government owes me reparations for something that happened centuries ago? I mean, it's an absurd argument, but I thought he made an excellent point. And this is coming from somebody, I mean, he's now an American citizen, but he's Hungarian, and he's a first-generation American. And I just thought that was an interesting point, and I wondered if I could get each of you to kind of weigh in on your thoughts about that.
I think part of the reason for it is because America is just so basically decent. We were founded on some very decent ideals by very decent people who came up with a way to run a government that was unlike anything else in the world and anything since, really. And one of the things that I talk about in my writer's workshop is the best way to create a character is by creating one who's, this is really kind of off the wall, but bear with me, by creating one who has a strength and a weakness, that their greatest strength and their greatest weakness is the exact same thing. And I think you can say that about America in general. We are incredibly decent. We are good, good people. We're generous. We do kind things just because we want to be nice. But that same decency gives us an overinflated sense of guilt. And we want to make reparations for those things that you can't ever make reparations for. So, of course, when you try to do that, you fall into the swamp of never being able to do it. That's my thought.
My feelings. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I agree, Jamie. Okay, yeah, jump in here, Michelle. We haven't, let me give you a chance to weigh in on this.
Well, first, I feel like all the things that were suffered through in World War II, that was such a short time ago, and it seems like the new generations, like, aren't even aware of it. I just can't even believe how they can be sucked into anything even resembles socialism, knowing everything that's been in the past. It's just astonishing. Yeah. As far as racism goes, Obama was supposed to bring everybody together because he was a black president. To me, I would say before he became president, we were so much closer than we are now, because my kids, and they have said this themselves, feel like there was no division in school, that they didn't think any different of one than another. You know, they would hang out with whoever, no matter whether they were black or Chinese or Mexican or whatever. And to me, it's become so much more to the forefront now. Now it's like an issue everywhere you go. You have to be careful who you say to what, because somebody's going to be offended, instead of it just being American. And it's to the point now that, you know, you should have a 5 hyphenated definition of what your ancestry is instead of just saying, I'm American.
Yep. I'm so with you on that, Michelle. Amen, sister. No hyphenations here. Go ahead, Griff, did you want to add to that?
The only thing is what Michelle was saying about them not knowing the ahistoricalness of modern American kids is really spooky. One might even think it was planned, but again, that's conspiracy theory. But it does certainly serve when people don't know their history, and then they really have nothing to compare it to. There's a great book by Theodore Dalrymple, who's an English physician, called Life at the Bottom, where he talks about the fact so many of his patients, where he worked at a hospital for basically the indigent and the poor in the slums of London, they didn't know when the Second World War had started. And so if people don't know something of that magnitude that so reshaped the world, but again, they know Beyonce's, and and they know that Jay-Z's getting jiggy with Obama, and things like that. But so they don't actually have the information, which is sort of shielded from them, the information that socialism and communism are a path to shared poverty and shared misery, and that more people have been lifted out of both those conditions by capitalism. So without that information, they just think they're fish. In terms of, this is water, this is where I've always been.
Go ahead, Jamie.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. The sad thing about that is that's very widespread. It's not relegated to just people who are have high school education or who are undereducated. It's people with college degrees, with master's degrees. Mm-hmm. I've talked to so many liberal writers out there who truly believe socialism is the way to go. I've talked to some really smart people who truly believe that, because they've been given so much misinformation that they've built their knowledge base on, that you can't get rid of it. It's part of their worldview, and if you got rid of that, they would have to relearn almost everything. And that's horrible.
And frightening.
Yep.
It's frightening,
yeah,
too. I mean, because that's your identity. Then it bridges on faith. You know, then we're talking about, oh my gosh, I've lost my faith. Who am I without that faith in the great state that will protect us cradle to grave?
And isn't that what you did with Alec Baldwin in your book?
Did I?
Yeah, you did.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah,
which reminds me, Chris. Let's give you an opportunity to plug your book. I didn't give you that opportunity yet, so this sounds like this is as good a time as any. So tell us about your book and where we can find it.
I have two novels out. One of them is called The Big Bang. It's volume one of the Chronicles of Lonesome George. It is a story of America after Al-Qaeda has had their way with us. It features a lot of different characters, including Alec Baldwin, Molly Ivins, George Bush, peripherally, as well as some ordinary people who are just part of the resistance, are trying to find their way through. And that's being published by Liberty Island at some point in the future. I'm not sure when. That's
hopefully soon.
One hopes. Jamie read it. God bless her.
I edited it.
She did. She was a great help.
Fantastic.
It's fantastic. It is really a good book. A lot of fun.
And then I also have another novel out, which is a historical fiction called By the Hands of Men. And that the title sums up the theme. It's a an English lieutenant during World War I falls in love with a woman, a nurse who works for the English Army. But fate takes them apart and actually takes them across the continent. And along the way, they learn that that the hands of men can make heaven or hell of earth, and it's by our choices we can find love, and love is what ultimately makes life worth living, love and service. And that book has some, to me, particular resonance for this period of time, because between World War I and into the late 30s, people were ignoring a lot of what was going on in the world around them.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's a subtle reflection, I hope, on what we're going through now. Because if you read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, the first third of the book talks about the way the press, for instance, and corporations were co-opted by that party, the Nazi party. And anyway, it just it goes from there.
And so where can we buy it? Go ahead.
Both of those are available on Amazon, and my website is called buythehandsofmen.com, and it's also available there.
Excellent. And I just wanted to say one thing, Griff, in response to your comments, because about maybe this isn't deliberate. I don't know if any of you have seen the documentary Grinding America Down by Curtis Bowers, who was a state representative from Idaho. But let me tell you something. When you watch this movie, which is completely documented and features people like Phyllis Schlafly and others who I consider very legitimate and very valid sources, you realize how much of the American communist agenda has been implemented. And when you look at the communist agenda and how they've very patiently implemented their agenda through the public school system and through pop culture, you realize, you know what, this is by design. And the mere fact that we even have a Department of Education in this country is just ridiculous. It's a farce. It should be locally controlled at the state level. And it goes against one of the principles of this country in the first place. So I would submit, and listen, I'll put my tinfoil hat on in this case, I would submit that this has all been done by design, that what's happening now is clearly not an act. Michelle or Jamie want to?
I want to speak on this because Griff has mentioned twice conspiracy theories. It doesn't. It's not true. I was listening to talk radio way back when Clinton was elected, and I started writing down my death panel book way back then, and because I believed that all these things that they were talking about and on all the different shows were going to come to some definite results. And any time anybody would call into these shows and say, well, this is going to result in this, and they say, oh, you're a conspiracy person that's hanging up on you. Well, now, fast forward to now, that book didn't end up getting published until 2010 when Obama was elected. Almost everything in that book has come true, including what I thought was really exaggerating the situation of saying they would control what we eat and don't eat by even if you're buying something in a vending machine, because in my story you have to use your debit number, not cash, to get anything. So they're tracking everything you eat. Well, look at New York. You can't buy a big gulp. You know, it's just everything is gone step by step. And that has been done through education and through entertainment, which is why we're trying to take the entertainment back. If you're not aware of the whole core curriculum issue, you need to become aware, because the core curriculum plans to make sure the same textbooks are used in every school in the entire country. And if you can't see where that's going, them determining what every child in this country learns all produced from the same person, that's pretty much a statement of control.
Yeah, Michelle, I have a lot of friends fighting back against that. Go ahead, Jamie, sorry.
about death panels, the way I've described that book is frighteningly precognitive. If you can get hold of a copy of Death Panels, read it. It is scary, and it is accurate. And she started writing it back in, what, 1993?
Yeah.
Around the time of Hillary Care.
I read it in 1994, and nobody would publish it because they were like, yeah, and I was a new writer, and I gave up. But
right. And it's amazing.
Well,
Michelle,
where
is that available? Can we buy it, Bill? Is it available online?
You can order it at bookstores. You can get it on Amazon, but you can also, if a bookstore doesn't have it in stock, they can order it for you.
Okay. Excellent. Well, I want to take a quick break. Can all of you kind of hang out here just for a couple of minutes? And on the other side of the break, I want to get into more about social media and how to be successful as a conservative fiction writer and all of those good things. So is everybody okay for a couple of minutes till we come back after the break?
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
All right. Okay, great.
Okay, yeah. Thanks, guys. Just a quick couple of minutes here so we can all take a stretch and get something to drink here. And we'll be right back with WriteStream and our WriteStream panel.
Hi, this is Lisa Tarvis. I'm a metaphysician, board-certified holistic health practitioner, energy healer, intuitive, and the author of the book, Just Believe. I'm also a host on the WriteStream Network. My radio show is called Just Believe and airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please stop by my website at www.lisatarvis.com. That's LISATARVES. For details on all the services I offer, information on my book, and my radio show, there are many amazing guests and fascinating topics scheduled for the show in the upcoming months. I look forward to connecting with you soon.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost,
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
Hi, this is Daria Ann, author and founder of the WriteStream Radio Network. If you're an author, writer, blogger, or just someone who enjoys reading and learning, I hope you'll tune in to our inspiring, insightful, and educational programs. Every Sunday, join author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvis for Just Believe at 1 p.m. Eastern, when she explores a variety of spiritual topics, including alternative healing modalities. A gifted intuitive from a young age, Lisa's book, entitled Just Believe, chronicles her journey from a childhood of seeing and communicating with angels to a career in which she uses her talents to help others emotionally, spiritually, and physically. Each week, she interviews experts in the fields of personal growth, spiritual development, and alternative medicine. Military Mondays with author and military historian John D. Gresham analyzes current events and issues from the perspective of the United States military. Tune in at 1 p.m. Eastern every Monday when John, author of such books as Uncommon Valor and journalist for the Defense Media Network, interviews accomplished guests on important topics like national security and defense and global terrorism. WriteStream Tuesdays with Daria Ann airs at 1 p.m. Eastern and welcomes authors in diverse genres, including romance, drama, military history, spirituality, and politics. We also speak social, discussing the benefits and pitfalls of social media platforms and the numerous and plentiful publishing formats now available with various experts in order to help other authors navigate through new technology to reach higher levels of success. During every broadcast, We welcome your call at 347-945-7246. And of course, the chat room is always open. Can't listen live? No worries. Just go to blogtalkradio.com/rightstream to listen to the archives. And be sure to join us for our weekly Thursday Rightstream Twitter chat at 11 a.m. Eastern using the hashtag Rightstream on Twitter. Rejoice in the flow of creativity with the Rightstream Radio Network and the Rightstream Twitter chat.
Okay, and we are back, and this is your host, Daria Ann. We're here with Rightstream, with our Rightstream Tuesday panel. We have Jamie Wilson, founder of Conservative Fiction, and authors Michelle Buckman and Griff Griffiths. So let me just go ahead and get them back on the line here. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
Everyone here?
Yes, yep. Ma'am.
All right. I just, you know, in the first half of the show, we talked a lot about, you know, the importance of conservative fiction and the need to take back the culture. In the second half of the show, Jamie, I want to kind of get into, you know, what makes good conservative fiction and what are some of the pitfalls with new media and independent publishing and, you know, what are some of the things that, that authors really, you know, the rules that maybe don't change for good fiction, because we want to make sure that we're putting out a good product. I think it's not enough, as Ava Aston, one of my favorites, singers out there who's also a conservative. She's an independent artist. I mean, she's told me many times, she goes, you know, it's not good enough just to be conservative. You actually have to be talented and good at what you do. So I want to kind of move the conversation in that direction in the second half of the show. So Jamie, let me start with you and kind of talk to that a little bit and about what's important for, you know, any aspiring writer, but especially someone in the conservative fiction realm. You know, what does it take to really put out a good product?
Well, first, you have to be better. You have to be better than the average liberal writer. It's not that hard for liberal writers to go out and get great big giant contracts because they're saying the things that the publishers want to talk about anyway. But if you're conservative, you've got to be better because you're not going to get listened to otherwise. One of the big failings I see in a lot of the conservative fiction I read and pick up on Amazon is free books and, you know, whatever, is they think it's enough to basically have a fictional rant. You know, this is bad, this is bad, this is bad, therefore this is what my story is going to be all about. And that's not true. You really need to combine it a lot with other things. Griff does a really good job of this, actually. He takes a traditional story and then he injects into it conservative ideas, you know, the idea of truth being more important. He shows the pitfalls of liberal idealism and propaganda. He writes a really good story, and then he puts conservatism into it. Michelle Buckman does the same thing, and that's why she is a successful traditionally published author, because she tells a damn good story, and she knows her audience, and she knows exactly what she needs to put in there to talk to them. So it really comes down to telling a good story to begin with. And after that, you worry about the politics. What my husband tells me is everything that I have ever written has got conservative elements in it. I just didn't know I was putting them in. Even when I was a liberal, I thought I was a liberal. I was putting them in. So...
yeah, that's the hallmark of a good story. But especially now, though, that I want to speak to this part of it, though, especially now that it's so easy for everybody to publish themselves, you know, in this age of new technology, what are some of the biggest mistakes that you see out there on the part of writers?
Poor editing is the number one. Just, you know, not running it past other people to catch the problems that you've put in your own writing. Not working with a community of writers who can help you learn what you're doing wrong, not getting out there and trying to make contact with people, not having beta readers, not doing all the things that you would do if you were an educated, informed, traditional writer, a liberal writer. Because
slow
liberal
down,
writers
Jamie.
Have... I'm sorry,
slow
go
down.
Ahead.
I'm still writing here, okay?
Oh my gosh, it really comes down to we need our own network of people who beginning writers especially can come to and say, is this any good? What should I do with it? How can I make this better? And that's what I'm trying to develop. You know, that's why I've got the writer's workshop that I'm building. I don't want to build a writer's workshop. I didn't start doing this because I wanted to build a writer's workshop. But I got out there and I looked at some of the very basic mistakes people were making, and I was like, oh, my God, we've got to do something to grow these people, because the stories were good. The people had the basic talent they needed, but they had absolutely no education. They had no idea how to tell a story in a written way. So, yeah, we need so much infrastructure, it's not even funny.
Griff, what are your thoughts on that? I agree. Yeah, absolutely. And it's wonderful that, I mean, what you're putting together, Jamie, is so valuable. Griff, do you have any thoughts on this topic?
Well, I think Michelle has a lot more experience, and her insight would be more valuable. The only thing I would add, and it's just really simply a confirmation, and Jamie and I have talked about this, but I think the story's got to be first. If you say, by golly, I'm going to talk about how bad X is, well, then it's propaganda. But if you've got the story first, I mean, certainly you're going to have your theme. You know, Michelle had her death panels, but she had a good story. She had the story of what if, instead of, I mean, if you start with your other thing, your propaganda, you're turning into Michael Moore. You know, he doesn't tell a story.
He presents
you the facts. Exactly. But it's propaganda. He has this predetermined outcome. So my only thing is, I think you've got to have the story first. And, of course, as Jamie says, skill and ability and patient people to read. But I want to hear what Michelle has to say, because she's been at this successfully much longer.
And teaches workshops. Lots of them.
Okay.
Well, yeah, I teach a lot of workshops. But I'm not as successful as I'd like to be. I'll put it that way. It would be nice if my books were all over the world and everybody was reading them. Then I would be really successful. But I'm just an average writer. My advice is workshops, workshops, workshops. What I see is lack of skill, and people think that it's so easy because everyone has a computer. You don't have to sit there and retype your handwritten notes onto an old typewriter with whiteout. You know, all you have to do is turn on your computer and type, and making corrections is so easy, and printing it out is so easy. And so everybody thinks that they're a writer, think that they can do it without learning anything, that they're just naturally born to be a great writer. And I hate to tell them this, but they're not. It's like any other skill. It has to be learned. It has to be practiced, and it has to be perfected. And that means, you know, going over and over and over. Somebody doesn't walk out onto a baseball field and think that they're going to be a home run hitter their first time out. You have to learn, and you have to study, and you have to listen to people who can give you good advice. And that's another thing, is make sure people you're getting advice from are people who are able to give you good advice. Because so often I see the blind leading the blind, and they're not giving them good advice. And sometimes manuscripts are ruined when they actually had a good basis of writing and somebody's led them astray on what they should or shouldn't do and ruined that innate ability that they did have. So that, as far as the basics of it, that is what's the biggest flaw I see. You've got to really work at it. You can't think the first thing that you sit down and write is going to be great. I threw away multiple manuscripts before I wrote the first one, which was A Piece of the Sky, that, you know, when I wrote it, I felt good about it, and I shared it with my critique group, and they're like, yeah, you finally did it, you know, and so I knew that was the right one. But like I said, I threw away a lot of manuscripts. It took a lot of learning. It took 15 years of writing before I wrote that one. So, and that's where I say perseverance as well. You have to be willing to put in the hours, to put in the work, to really learn this and do it the right way, not just scratch something down, first book, oh, you think it's great, your mom likes it, your uncle likes it, it must be good. No.
Yeah.
And let me say something here. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to comment on the perseverance thing, you know, it taking 15 years. It does. It takes a lot of time. And unfortunately, right now, we've got two things going on that are short-circuiting that, and especially the conservative fiction world. First of all, we've got it to where it's really easy to just publish a book. Just throw it out there. It's there. But secondly, we have this incredible sense of urgency. We have let this wait way too long. And now we need to get this out there. And we need to do it now. And we don't have the writers to do it. And because of that, our quality, it stinks in a lot of ways. A lot of the writers out there are just, again, great writers, great storytellers, not ready for prime time. They really need work. And as a result, I'm very afraid that a lot of what we put out there is going to be ridiculed by the liberals, and rightly, because it's not, again, not ready for prime time, and it's going to get a bad reputation right off the bat. So that's something that we need to figure out how to fix.
Yeah. I'd like to get each of your input. Go ahead, Michelle, sorry.
Well, I was going to say is I think the same thing happened with Christian fiction. When it first started up, there was a lot of really bad stuff, and so people started thinking, oh, Christian fiction, that's really bad. But then writers started coming out that actually had skill and saw, oh, I actually have a place that I can get this published, and they started having conferences and workshops and everything and built it up. So I'm fully confident that there are good writers out there that would like to write conservative fiction that are working at honing their skills. They just don't know where to take their work. And I think once the outlets are more public, more available, there will be real rise in it, just like it was in the Christian fiction market, because now the Christian fiction is huge, and it was unheard of, you know, a decade or so ago. So it will open up. And that, to me, that's the other big thing, is to attend conferences and attend workshops, because that's where you're going to meet people that have been in the business a long time, and you're going to really learn stuff.
Yep.
Yeah.
And
that's the next thing I wanted to ask about all of you. And, Michelle, I can start with you, because I interview a lot of writers on this program, and I get kind of like, I think it's like a 50-50 reaction. Some people are really into writers' groups, and they swear by them. And an example is Harriet Park, who wrote the excellent dystopia Agenda 21. And others have said to me, no, I'm not really into that. You know, I don't like that. You know, I had a bad experience. It just seemed like all they wanted to do was cut me down. So I do think there's a difference between constructive criticism and criticism, because let's face it, we're all human, and we all, people are not unaffected by the green-eyed monster. So, Michelle, I want to start with you, and I just on thoughts on how to find, and I think you kind of answered this, but thoughts on how to find a group that's going to be supportive and criticize you constructively versus one that's just out to tear people down because maybe they're jealous because you're moving along and they're not.
Well, I had one of my early manuscripts completely ruined by a critique group because I took their advice, and I ended up sticking that manuscript in a box and not doing anything with it. And I'm going to pull it back because it's still my favorite, and now I understand what I need to do with it and how much they messed that manuscript up. And that's why I say know who's critiquing your work. Know whether or not they're qualified. And I'm not saying that it has to be somebody that's a professional writer, but some people give bad advice because they don't know themselves. Some people, I'll tell you, my best critique partner way back was a woman who was not a writer at all. She was an avid reader. She could look at the book and tell me where things were going wrong because when you read constantly, you know what should happen in a book. You learn those steps. And she was one of those people. She could spot it. And she also was great at asking questions, which is what I tell new writers to do, to develop somebody that you can sit down and say, okay, this is my character, and let them fire questions at you about, well, this isn't plausible, or why would you make that happen, or what's your motivation for doing that? That doesn't make sense to me. So you can get all those questions pounded by an outsider, and it will really build up who your character is, whether or not your plot is convincible. And that's what you have to have for the core of it. So it doesn't necessarily have to be another writer, but you have to make sure that you're getting good direction and not bad direction, and whether that's in a live full critique group or an online group doesn't make any difference. You just have to find ones that fit. And I'll tell you what I ended up doing was I had belonged to 5 different online groups when I first got on the internet, and I ended up getting down to 3 core critiquers that were, we didn't write anything alike. We were in totally different genres, but we understood how to critique without changing each other's voices. One was a country western writer, which obviously is nothing like women's fiction, which is what I tend to write, but we could really tell each other what worked and didn't work without saying, you should change how you're writing these sentences, because that's not what a critique partner should do. So,
right.
That's my thing.
Right.
Well, actually, if I may, what you just said there about the reader touches on the one bit of advice I think anybody who wants to be a writer needs to do is they need to read. My wife is a school teacher, and as soon as you read any essays from some of her students, you can see that these kids have not read a lot. They just haven't absorbed the conventions and the rhythms of written speech, if you will. And so that needs to be happening as well.
Jamie, have anything else there?
No, I completely concur.
So let me pick on one other thing. When you were talking about the difference with conservative versus what's out there right now, Griff was saying this, and Jamie both, that the story is what needs to come first. And the difference, which we touched on this from the beginning of the show, the difference is when in a liberal movie on TV or in a romance novel or whatever, you know, the people meet and this couple look at each other and they're like, oh, wow, you're really hot, and they jump into bed. And then it goes on with the rest of the plot. Well, the difference with conservative fiction is they look at each other and they don't jump into bed, but it doesn't change the plot. That's how I see it. You can still have the same stories, the same actions, the same, you know, you still want to create just a really good moving story with a good plot. You just don't want your characters to make immoral choices all the way through it.
You know, what you're saying to me is, it is what you're talking about is earning the emotional payoff in your story. You know, because if when you just have the characters jump into bed immediately, there's no emotional investment by the reader or the characters. Whereas, you know, the thing you're describing, Michelle, is about writing a story in such a way that you've earned the empathy and the involvement of the reader is not just assumed or taken for granted by just throwing out a couple of tropes that everyone is used to seeing.
Yeah.
To me, that's lazy writing, what you're talking about. And you see that a lot in movies, and it just drives me crazy because the person who's going to get in the way of the cool protagonist is going to be a fundamental Christian. And if they're a fundamental Christian, they're probably a hypocrite and a thief and so on and so on and so on. And that's so incredibly lazy. You know, I mean, it's the shorthand that all the cool kids use because they understand it. It's like instead of talking about the nerds, they can talk about, you know, oh, those Christians. And it's a very high school level. But it's also just really lazy writing. And I think, you know, Michelle is talking about writing that's actually robust and takes some time and some care and some thought.
Yeah, some development, character development.
Yeah.
And Jamie, you know, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead. Oh, okay.
No, I promise I'll shut up. No, go ahead.
Okay, well, that touches on something that I mentioned just the other day in the writer's group that I've really been thinking about, and that's a lot of what's being taught now in writer's workshops on a college level, on a personal level, anywhere, is very lazy. A lot of it's shortcuts. A lot of the common wisdom that's being taught right now is really just lazy writing. And I think it's time that we start questioning a lot of it.
Oh, yeah. I agree.
So, anyway, go ahead.
Now, and the reason what I was going to say was, Michelle, when you mentioned romance novels, Jamie, it reminded me of our conversation on a previous WriteStream broadcast, because you were making the great point, and I never thought of it this way, that romance novels are essentially conservative because the couple ends up in a relationship, or it's not a marriage. I mean, that seems to be the end goal of most romance novels, and I don't read a lot of them anymore. I used to love Kathleen Woodiwiss, is that her name? Her historical romances.
Yeah.
But even her characters, they weren't out for one night stand. I mean, they were out for the whole deal. I mean, they wanted the relationship, the long-term relationship, and ultimately the marriage. And I just thought that was such an interesting point that you had brought up before, and I wondered if you wanted to touch on that again today.
I don't know what I can say to expand on it. Woodiwiss was the original bodice ripper. She really was. And her writing changed romance actually kind of in a negative way, because she's the one who really brought a lot of the explicit sex and things like that into it. And I think one of the biggest mistakes romance writers today make is following the formula. There's a formula out there, and it's not written down anywhere, but if you read enough romances, you pick up on it pretty quickly. By the middle of a sweet romance, a romance that doesn't have a lot of sex in it, or any sex at all sometimes, by the middle of that sweet romance, the characters have to kiss right there, right there at that center point. And I don't know if you ever read Harlequins or anything, but they always had the little card where you could subscribe to the Harlequin Club right in the middle. Well, you would always find the kissing scene. And that's said with capital letters. That's what I always call it. You'd always find a kissing scene within about two pages of that middle postcard. And I don't know. They may have been doing that partly, at least for marketing purposes. I mean, you get to the kissing scene, you're like, oh, yeah, I want to subscribe to these. But it's
yeah.
the formula, and that's
it
what
is.
They did. And if you go through and you look at other contemporary romances, whether you're talking single romances that are out on the bestseller list or the line romances like Harlequin, you can pretty much predict within, you know, after reading 10 or so of them, where the sex scene is going to be, where the kissing scene is going to be, where things get a little more intense with the two heroes. And that's, honestly, that's bad writing. It's what people expect. It really
yep.
is. But it's bad writing.
I totally agree.
Because those things don't necessarily move your story forward. And if you're not moving your story forward, then you're not really writing a story. So I think that's really all I have to say, you know, beyond what we talked about.
No, and I agree with. It's funny you brought that up, because years ago, and Michelle, I'll let you jump back in here in a second. I just wanted to make this point. Many years ago, a writer friend of mine who was a romance novelist invited me to I think it was Romance Writers of America. I'm not sure, and I'm not. Yeah, and I went to this meeting, and I was all excited about it. This was probably back in, like, 1996. And I was so turned off, because that's all they talked about. Here's your formula. If you want to write for X publisher, well, they're more explicit, so your sex scene has to have this, this, and this. I mean, it really was formulaic. I mean, they were, and they made no bones about it, and I left there feeling so disillusioned by the whole thing that I don't think I ever picked up a romance novel again after that, or ever even entertained any thoughts of writing for any kind of romance novel publication. So that's exactly, you're absolutely right. There is a specific formula, and I found it to be a real turnoff. Michelle, do you want to jump back in here? I know you wanted to add to what we were talking about.
Well, I was just saying that I totally agree about the romance formula thing. I hate that. I don't read romances. I had one agent that he kept begging me to write romances because that's what would sell, and I couldn't do it. I said, no, forget it. So I moved on. But I think part of the reason that they do sell, I'm not talking about the erotic ones, I'm talking about the ones that are plain romance, is because that's another way they can read, people can read novels that aren't full of liberal stuff. And that goes back to what I was just saying about, you know, you watch a movie or read a book that they have to throw people into bed because they think that's going to make it sell. And I think, to me, that's what's turning people off. Because, you know, there's so many even just shows on TV now that we would watch for 5 minutes or movies even, and we turn them off because that's what they have to show in every one. And to me, that is a major difference between the conservative and liberal writing, is not just our overall goal of what might happen in the book, but keeping morals within it. And I'm not saying that, you know, everybody has to wear, you know, long skirts or whatever. I'm not saying they have to be like
turtleneck,
you know, Amish or anything like that. It's a matter of, are you going to live by a set of morals or not? In these stories, stories of just, you know, people meet, they're going to have sex. People go meet, they're going to have sex. It's over and over and over, and it makes me insane. Why do you even have to interject that into a story if it's an action story? What does it have to do with that? Nothing.
Right.
You can still have that romantic tension, which, you know, is in almost anything you'd write. There's romantic tension. But romantic tension works better when nothing culminates, because that's what keeps the tension.
Right.
Are they really going to get, like, what was that show you see on TV a long time ago? JAG. You know, it was that you were always wondering if they were going to get together sometime during the show. It kept you watching it, you know, and that's what really works. That, like Jamie was saying, that is good writing, not easy writing, because you have to have something that will further that tension all the way through, and that's what you want. And maintaining that takes work, to maintain that and keep the interest up and still keep it real and emotional. That takes work. It's not like a typical romance novel where you throw in, oh, they're going to have a little argument about something, and that's going to beat each other for the next three chapters before all of a sudden they realize, oh, madly in love, let's get there.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that. It's really good writing. You're really thinking about motivation. You're really thinking about how the plot is impacting their lives and them, and that's creating more tension.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, listen, our panel, Jane, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but we do have a caller on the line. I don't have the ability to screen, unfortunately, because I don't have a producer, so this could be an adventure, but are you all up for taking a call?
Please.
Okay.
Sure.
All right. So caller from the 718 area code, you are on Write Stream Tuesday with our conservative fiction panel.
Hi, Daria. I hate to ruin your adventure, but it's just me, Declan Finn.
Declan, hey!
Oh, cool.
Hey. Hi.
Hey,
hi there. Yeah, so don't worry, I'm not going to be that interesting. I just had a question. You folks, well, I've got several comments, but if I did, I'd blow the rest of your time. But in terms of writing formulas, now, one of the most formulaic people out there, you know, I won't mention his name, Dan Brown, has some of the most cliched, hackneyed writing I think I've ever seen, and yet I'm not sure if he sells millions of copies or if it just feels like they dump millions of copies right in front of us at Barnes & Noble and pray that we get rid of all of them for them. But what would you explain, well, him or people like him?
I have
how many
theory.
Okay, I was going to say, my thought is, how many hamburgers does McDonald's sell?
Well, yeah.
You know, it's a dependable product that is cheap and doesn't require a lot out of you. you know, and I guess I read one of his books, I think, and you know, a sort of a different story. That was the one thing. It's something we hadn't seen before, but it was pretty schlocky in its presentation. But at least it wasn't something we'd seen a lot of. And not that it was well done. That's my thought. Jamie?
Well, back in the 1990s, there was this book that came out, Holy Blood, Holy Grail. I picked it up because it was really interesting. And I read it, and I thought, oh, my gosh, this would make, you know, it was supposedly truthful. They had done historical research and figured all this stuff out about Jesus. And I'm sitting there going, wow, that would make such an interesting novel. Well, later on, Dan Brown turned it into a novel. That was his first big novel. He ripped off that book wholesale. I could go down and mark everything in his book that he had ripped off from Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And the writers of Holy Blood, Holy Grail sued him later, but of course, since they put their book out as nonfiction, they didn't get anything. But I think that's what happened. He put that one book out that had such a great idea behind it that he ripped off from somebody else entirely. And every other book since then, he has based on that one great success. And because he has a lot of face value, people know who he is and they know what to expect from his books, it's very easy to sell his books. So publishers look at him as an easy sell. So they publish lots of books. They get spread all over the tables and people buy them.
Yeah, brand recognition.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I was just curious because I got to tell you, yes, schlocky writing, two-dimensional characters, and I'm sorry, it didn't feel original to me. It's like, wow, the evil Catholic Church, isn't this every other plot from, hell, my childhood? Sorry, I'm 31, just to narrow it down.
I would say also it's because it wasn't just aimed at the Catholic Church, it was aimed at Christians in general, and it was controversial. So being controversial, it raised the eyebrows of some people, which got people talking about it and fighting about it, which was a great marketing tool. And when you can market based on something, then you get it in front of people. And, you know, the more it's in front of them, the more they talk about it. And so then everybody wants to read it because everybody's talking about it.
Well, by that standard, as conservatives, shouldn't we throw our books in front of every liberal out there and get them pissed off and talking about it?
That's a good plan.
Yeah, and you know, by the same token, and I agree with what everybody said, but by the same token, then, if it's controversy, why aren't we seeing any books about Muhammad or Islam? You know, I mean, we see, you know, nonfiction bloggers like Pamela Geller being absolutely chastised for telling the truth, but what if there was a fictional novel that picked on Islam?
Well, then you get the life that Salman Rushdie had of living in isolation with 12 guards for about 10 years when there's a fatwa on you. And that's the other reason that Christians are such an easy target. Christians, Catholics, are such an easy target in film and novels. We don't go blow up people's houses. We don't kill their children.
Yep.
So it's a way to be safely edgy.
That's a great term, safely edgy. That's perfect.
Yeah.
I love that.
Mm. Oh, by the way, Daria, to answer your question about people who examine Muhammad in a not exactly positive light, you might want to look at Tom Kratman of Bay and Books, but he's science fiction and people go after him all the time and he shoots back. I suspect he has real ammo somewhere.
Oh, I'm sure he has real ammo somewhere. I know he has real ammo somewhere because I know his friends.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
Yes.
Declan, do you have any other questions? Any other comments or questions?
Well, just a comment. I think everyone here would find amusing. Has anyone heard news from the Science Fiction Writers of America lately?
Oh, no.
Oh, the cyber shaming.
Yes, the cyber shaming. Okay. Where liberals eat their own. It's always fun to watch.
Right. Yes. Which one? What's going on here?
Basically, one of their members was being ripped for not being sufficiently good and liberal, and they wind up in a nice little fist fight. But if you look at most of the blogs, you look down their comments, and it's, you know, this sort of stuff doesn't happen with Bayon. They actually encourage free thought.
Yep.
What a concept.
Yep. I love them.
Yeah.
This is beyond, I guess, the liberal of the, the Elizabeth Moon controversy?
Yeah.
Moon's name did not come up. Not that I saw.
This was, I think, Barry Malzberg and Mike Resnick.
Yep.
Oh, my God, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
I might have a link
out.
To that.
I know, Mike. I got to check that out.
Oh. Declan, do you have anything else you want to add before we...
Nope. I'd only just ask that you might want to talk about Vince Flynn, may he rest in peace, or maybe even Brad Soar, as far as conservative authors go.
Excellent point.
All right.
Yeah, that was...
I'll shut up now.
No, thank you for calling in, Declan. I appreciate it.
Always happy to help.
Have a great day. Okay. You too.
Bye.
And you know what, guys, that is a really good point. I neglected to bring up Vince Flynn, and gosh, so sad. He was so young. But, you know, may he rest in peace, and he was an incredible author. Can I get each of you to comment on that? Anybody want to jump in?
Well, I have to be honest. I've never read the guy. That may be heresy amongst this elite group. But Jamie knows pretty much I read nonfiction. As research for the fiction I write. So I don't read very much fiction these days.
Although that may change now that you've been exposed to so much fiction that's, you know, not, you know, liberal.
Yeah. That stuff, yes.
Claptrap.
That's true.
Yeah.
True. Well, guys, you know, in the last like 20 minutes or so, I want to kind of get into some of the marketing thoughts that you have, you know, with new media and social media. And I want to start with blogging. I mean, what are your thoughts on blogging, and how important is it for authors to have a blog, and how often should you be writing, and how should you go about that to engage your audience? Jamie, let me just start with you, and we'll go down the line.
I think you need a blog. You have to have a blog these days in order just have your name listed properly in Google, but I don't think a blog's going to sell your books. You've got to have some recognition out there first.
Recognition
that's
in terms of,
it.
You think, like, in terms of winning awards or for your writing? Or
awards are okay. Awards help a little bit, but really you need to have things written about you. You need to have people talking about you. If you've got a good Facebook following and lots of good links that way, that often helps. The problem with a blog, it's kind of out there anchorless. And people come to read it or they don't come to read it. It doesn't really matter. Facebook and Twitter and things like that, you've got people that you're actively pushing things out to. And that does make a big difference. So Facebook is probably going to sell more books than a blog is, but you've got to have the blog there just so people can have someone to go to for information, and so Google lists you properly.
Well, what do you think about using the, you know, posting on the blog and using some of those platforms to push out the content there? I mean, is that something you recommend? Okay.
Yeah, that's fine. That works great.
Griff, what do you – okay.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Cool. No, I'm sorry. You know what? I just want to make sure everybody gets a chance to weigh in because it's crazy. We're almost – I mean, I've enjoyed this so much, and we're already down to, like, the last segment of the show. But, Griff, so what are your thoughts on blogging?
Okay. Well, again, I don't think I'm necessarily the one to speak to this authoritatively. I haven't had a lot of success with my books, other than Liberty Island, and although I'm, you know, trying to learn at the feet of Michelle and Jamie on how to improve, for instance, my book, selling my book by the hands of men. I do have a blog. But maybe I'm a lazy writer because I find I don't like to market. I find it takes time away from actually creating stuff. But I may need to, you know, find that myself. And my other thought is you see something about people who are, you know, this writer got a contract and they're an inveterate Twitterer. And my thought is, how the hell can anybody write anything good if you're spending all your time on the social media? So there may be a balance there that I have not found myself. But that being said, I'd like to hear what Michelle has to say.
Well, actually, Griff, I'm pretty much with you on that, to opposite of Jamie here. I do have a blog, but it has nothing to do with my writing. It has to do with Catholic Truth, is what it is. That's actually the name of it, Catholic Truth. And I only write that because so much false information is given about Catholics, especially in the South, which is where I live. So I started writing it just to put out there the truth of what we believe, because there's so many people in the South that don't think we're Christian, whereas we are the foundation of Christianity, and they don't... They're so uneducated about Catholicism, they don't understand that every denomination, Christian denomination, came from Catholicism. So that's why I started writing my Catholic Truth. I do not use it to sell my books. My thought on blogs are that you need other people that have blogs to write about you in your book. If they can review it or interview you on it or something, that does help. But I do not think that me having a blog where I talk about myself I couldn't come up with some subject. What am I going to talk about that would make somebody want to read my books? Something about my characters? It was just a chore to me. And I was like, this doesn't make sense. I can't do it. I do have a website where people can go and read my bio, read book reviews, read about whatever new books I have coming out. They can read about my workshops or if there's conferences I'm speaking at, all that is on my website, so they can find out information about me. But I don't think the time that it would take me to write a blog that was just trying to get people to read my books would help. I have a Facebook page because my publishers told me I had a Facebook page. I don't know that that's helped because a lot of times it's other writers that come and join it, and they're just trying to promote their books to me. So I can't say that that's necessarily been a winning tool either. I have Twitter, but I'm not a Twitter person, so I, like, post something there, like, once a month. So you're asking the wrong person. I use social media, so I have support from people. I can go out there and talk to my other writer friends and find out what's going on in the publishing world. I'm bad at promoting myself through the media.
Well,
I just am. I love it when other people will do it for me, though.
Yeah, well, I think the key with social media is engagement versus broadcasting, and I could do a whole show on that, and I have in the past. But Michelle, I definitely, when you were talking about, I love that you created a blog to push back against all the falsehoods about the Catholic Church out there, and I think I may need to bring you back on another show just to talk about that because in the wake of the Pope's resignation this year and the election of a new Pope, I came across so much anti-Catholic bigotry, and sorry to say, among people with whom I share common cause in terms of the Constitution, but I was just appalled at what they actually believe about what we believe. And so, it was a real eye-opening experience for me. So I think I'm going to have to bring you back just to discuss that in the future. It's really scary what the misinformation that's out there.
Yes, so. It is.
But Jamie, okay, so let's get back. So Jamie does use social media. So what are the platforms? I know you mentioned Facebook, Jamie, but what and Twitter. So are there any other platforms that you recommend, or are those the two that you use the most?
Well, what you really have to do is ask yourself how you find the books that you read. If you're finding lots of books through Twitter or through your friends on Facebook or things like that, that's probably how you need to go out and push your stuff. But other things, LinkedIn is great for networking behind the scenes. It's not so great for selling your books. Trying to think of some of the others that I use.
Well, you know, I had an author. What do you think of Pinterest? Because I had an author on recently who said that she creates storyboards on there, and that's actually helped her in terms of book sales.
That's a really interesting idea. I've never used Pinterest. Pinterest doesn't interest me. So it's not something that I ever see myself getting into. And I don't think it's really going to last that much longer, honestly.
Really? Okay, interesting. That's an interesting point.
That's just my feeling. So it's more visual media, Pinterest is, than it is written media. And that's probably part of why it appeals to me. Mostly when I find books, I find them because writers who I love have recommended them, or because, folks that I know personally have said, you've got to read this book.
Yeah, and Griff, you made a good point that I think you were right about the balance. Because I do use social media a lot, but I think that the danger in that, too, for a writer, for an author, is that you can get so caught up in socializing with people on Twitter that you don't actually get any work done and create things, as you say. So that's definitely the downside of it, too, one of the downsides.
Well, maybe really the value of social media to a writer is that it does help you network, because then you can get those people who will recommend your book or who will give you advice on what to do and where to go and who to talk to, you know, more than it is marketing. Marketing
I agree with that. But I think that most people buy their books because of word of mouth, because they hear somebody likes it. Mm-hmm. And so if somebody else on social media is talking about your book, that's why I say somebody else with a blog that reviews your book, or somebody, does Twitter or Facebook post about your book, that helps. But I think if you have a Facebook or Twitter and you're just constantly saying, buy my book, that's not going to work.
No. That's how you get unsubscribes.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's where the engagement concept comes in, though, where you're more engaging than broadcasting. But that's a whole other piece of it. But as we are winding down, like we have the last 10 minutes, I want to just kind of go around and give each of you an opportunity to, again, let everybody know where they can find you, and any final thoughts that you might have about conservative fiction or advice for aspiring authors. So, Michelle, let me start with you.
Ooh, okay. I think the best thing that anybody who's interested in conservative fiction can do is to support other conservative writers and buy their books and talk about them, because that's what we need as a movement, and it's going to start with anybody who's listening that wants to help do that. It takes everybody to get out there marketing and buying, because it's like any other marketing thing. If people aren't buying it, it will dry up and go away, and if people support it, then it will thrive and grow. So that's what we need. And to that end, go out and buy Death Panels and Rachel's Contrition and Maggie Completely and My Beautiful Disaster.
And visit MichelleBuckman.com, right?
Yes, MichelleBuckman.com. There's links on there to where you can buy them. Absolutely.
Fantastic. Okay, Griff, you want to go next? Sure.
Oh, gosh. As far as conservative fiction goes, I think Michelle had a terrific idea. We do what we can to support good work of any kind. And also, we just need to keep doing it. I think the more visibility we get, I'm going to have to now making a note myself to mention Michelle on my Facebook page, because there are the people who liked my novel would probably find similar thing hers. Mine is when Jamie's talking about romance, I thought mine's almost like that, and that there's no pointing. Yeah, as we get the visibility, people will know that we're out there. And Jamie, God love her, she's working really hard to make sure we get some visibility. She's doing. In fact, I want to hear about Jamie's writing just before we leave. And
me too.
Yeah, because right now she's the Maxwell Perkins of the conservative fiction movement. She's editing me. She's promoting. She's working really hard. But I know she's also a writer. In fact, I think she was a writer first. But she's just so damn good at these other things. She has the curse of confidence. But I digress. Yes, conservative fiction. We just need to get the visibility, because people don't know it's out there. And as people learn we're there, we're available, and that we have a point of view that may not insult them, and may entertain them, they'll come and look for us. So in
vote
that case,
with
Michelle,
your dollars. That's the
yes.
whole point. Vote with your dollars.
Right. So in that case, Michelle's absolutely correct. And you can find my exciting book on Amazon. It's available for Kindle, both The Big Bang and By the Hands of Men. And The Big Bang will be published by Liberty Island sometime soon, according to my editor, Jamie.
I hope so.
Yes, ma'am. And you can find me at bythehandsofmen.com. Where there's occasionally pictures of my cats, who keep me coming when I write.
Wow, I love cats. I'll have to check that out.
Okay. And now, Jamie, please tell us a little bit about your writing as well.
All about it. I can't tell you all about it. Most of my writing is informed by where I was brought up. I was very Appalachian in my upbringing. And so one of my favorite characters is Helen Highwater, who is a... you call a wise woman, I guess. She sees into two worlds. And one short story from the Helen Highwater universe has Helen helping a woman who is being haunted by the ghost of her aborted child. And
wow. Powerful.
Very good story. Very good.
Liberty Island picked that one up. That's the Biscuit Boy. So that should come out in the first issue of their magazine whenever they get that moving. But I've written several Helen Highwater stories. I've also got some other interesting stories out there, including a world where a secret family of people are reborn generation after generation into their own descendants, and they remember everything. So it's a different kind of immortal, something that I was setting out to do on purpose a few years ago, and they're a lot of fun. And I go into a lot of political stuff with them, and they're fun. But that's not something I'm even prepared to talk about right now. So as far as other things, I agree with everything that was said. If you want more of it, you got to buy it. And
If there are writers out there who are listening right now, please come talk to me. We can get you involved in the group. We can get you involved in a writer's workshop if you feel like you need more work. And if you're not sure, we can tell you. And just come out, join us, and let's get a movement going.
Sounds good to me. Now, Jamie, conservativefiction.com is where they can go to join the forum. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's a link to the forum on the left-hand side of the page, and they can just come in there. But I do ask people who are coming to join the forum, if you're a writer, come and tell me. Just email me at kywright@gmail.com.
Okay.
And let me know that you're a writer and you want to be in the writer's forums, and we can get you hooked up with that.
Excellent. And just one more time, the writer's retreat is going to be in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, and what are the dates again for that?
It's going to be the 23rd through the 27th. The 23rd is mostly just going to be, hey, how are you? Nice to actually see you in person. And after that, we'll get into the real business.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be great. I'm going to try to make that.
Oh, it is. Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm going to try.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I'll do my best because I'm actually going to be in Tennessee next month and maybe permanently. We'll see how that goes. But because my brother has lived there for many years and without getting into a long story, I'm kind of ready to try something new. So, I'm going to really do my best to be there. It'll be fun.
It's a nice state.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It really is. But I want to thank all of you today, my panel, Michelle Buckman, Griff Griffith, and Jamie K. Wilson for joining me today. I really enjoyed this, and I hope we can do it again in the near future.
Thank you for having me.
I hope so, too.
That'll be fun.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. All right, guys, listen, have a great day. And, again, thanks for being part of the panel. And for anyone listening, we will do this again soon, and maybe we'll tackle some different topics. We'll get more into specifics with certain things next time, and I'll bring these excellent writers and people back. So until then, keep rejoicing in the flow of creativity, and I'll see you back here again for another Write Stream Tuesday. Take care, everyone.
Thanks, Dora.